Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program here. It's a pleasure to have you all with us today for what I'm certain is going to be an extremely interesting discussion, a look at the Cuban economy, prospects for change. There are so many aspects of Cuban's economic development that will be of interest to us, looking at the possibilities for economic reform, for broadening of individual initiative in Cuba, look at the damage to Cuba in the past round of hurricanes, how that's affected the country, as well as other areas of interest, for example, energy, where there are some interesting new developments that will certainly be a topic of discussion here today. We are extremely fortunate today to have an unusually distinguished panel of speakers. We will begin with Professor Terry L. Maris, who is Professor of Management, Executive Director for the Center for Cuban Business Studies at the Ohio Northern University. Dr. Maris has recently returned from a visit to Cuba. I'm sure we'll have some interesting prospects or interesting discussion to offer. Professor Emily Morris, who is the Director of the Research Unit of the International Institute for the Study of Cuba, based at London Metropolitan University. Professor Morris, for many years, was an analyst and editor of the Economist Intelligence Unit, where she focused on Cuba and other countries. And Professor Archibald R.M. Ritter, distinguished research professor emeritus at the Department of Economics and the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University, one of the leading world experts on the Cuban economy, as are our other two distinguished panelists. We will go in alphabetical order, starting with Dr. Maris, followed by Professor Morris and Dr. Ritter. Following the presentations by our three panelists, we'll have a good opportunity for questions and answers. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Maris and invite him to begin the session.
Here with my colleagues, our paths have crossed on many occasions before. We've decided this is a rather small community, a small fraternity, as it were, of those who are interested in and study Cuba. Peter mentioned that I've just returned from Cuba. I was there 12 days ago, and I'm pleased to hear that Arch is going to take up the slack. He's heading there in a few days. So frequent visits to the island, I think, are very, very important to stay in touch. I'm going to concentrate on energy. This is such a broad topic that I thought that I better narrow my remarks. And what I've done, I've culled some information, some data from a manuscript that I'm working on right now. And actually, it's an update of one that a colleague of mine and I wrote about 3 or 4 years ago. This has not been submitted yet for publication, but will be. And there's another one. I hope you don't consider this self-promotion. But by way of information, I have had an article just recently accepted for publication in Military Review, and that will deal with the role of the Revolutionary Armed Forces in Cuba in the current status and the future of the Cuban economy. By way of background on energy, I'd like to very, very briefly cite some information about the world oil situation. If you've been following the news closely as it pertains to energy prices, I know you're all following the economy, trying to forget last Friday, and we'll look forward to a good week on the markets. But a few facts. What happened Friday, right? Okay. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Friday was good. Yesterday was bad. Well, you know what I do? I read the world markets every day when I wake up. And if you do, you can look at what's coming. It's not always a perfect predictor. One of the things I'd like to establish as a fact is that 50% of the world's proven oil reserves have been depleted. If you were to plot a bell curve, and I chose not to do a PowerPoint presentation here today. My colleagues, I believe, will avail themselves of that method. But if you can imagine a bell curve, all the known oil reserves in the world, we are at or to the right of that bell-shaped curve. Oil resources are rapidly being depleted. There is a, we've all heard of return on investment. There's another term that some of you may be familiar with. That's the energy return on energy invested. This is a number that is declining rapidly. 50 years ago, it required one barrel of oil to extract 30 barrels. The ratio now is down to 4 to 1. When that number reaches 1 to 1, the extraction and refinement of oil will no longer be economically viable. There'll be no advantage to extracting it. And that's a rather sobering thought. So put that in the back of your mind. At the OPEC meeting in Cairo Saturday, we thought there might be a decision on production cuts, but that was postponed. It was postponed to the meeting later this month in Algeria. As you know, 40% of all the world's oil comes from OPEC nations. They're not all 100% cooperative. We see Venezuela sometimes on the sidelines. Crude prices have fallen from 60% in mid-July, down from a high of 147, down to their present level, slightly below $50. As far as target markets in the economy, Saudi Arabia, in an unusual statement recently, indicated they thought $75 per barrel would be a reasonable price on the market. So when we see OPEC meet in Algeria, we're going to look for a discussion. And most analysts are predicting cuts of about 1.5 million barrels. So enough for the world scene. I'd like to talk very briefly about Venezuela before we get into the data about Cuba. And again, these are just a very few highlights here. In October 2000, an agreement was signed, I would say between the Cuban government and the Venezuelan government, but that's not exactly truthful. It was really an agreement signed by Fidel and Hugo. And the more significant part of that, I think, is that my Venezuelan friends, and I was in Venezuela recently talking with some folks down there, are increasingly feeling disenfranchised from President Chavez. Approximately 53,000 barrels a day of Venezuelan oil are being exported from Venezuela to Cuba. Approximately 8 to 10 shipments per month. When I'm down there, it's interesting. Occasionally, I will see the Venezuelan tankers come in. This agreement signed in 2000 was a 15-year agreement. Cuba pays for only 25% of the market value, the world value, market value of the oil at that time of the transaction. 2% interest and a 2-year grace period. So very, very favorable terms. I don't know what business person wouldn't like terms like that. In December of 2004, another agreement was signed. This increased the export quota to 90,000 barrels a day and established an office of the PDVSA, the Petróleos de Venezuela office in Havana. I don't have time to go into all the ramifications of that. This is not necessarily a good development for the Cuban people. But now Hugo Chavez and his oil people have an office in Havana and are ever more actively involved in the energy market in Cuba. The more recent April 2005 agreement, there are 30,000 healthcare workers working in Venezuela. Several of you have read about this program. It also guaranteed 1,000 free medical centers to be built by the Cubans in Venezuela in remote locations, training for up to 50,000 Venezuelan medical personnel, and free surgical treatment for up to 100,000 Venezuelans in Cuba. By way of an anecdote on that, my landlord of Mi Casa Particular in Cuba was commenting on this. He had an impacted wisdom tooth, and it was causing him great pain. He finally got it taken care of, and he was lamenting the fact that he had to wait so long to get treatment, and then he started cursing this agreement, saying all the good doctors and the oral surgeons are now in Venezuela, so we poor Cubans have to wait. So there's a man-on-the-street perspective. The title of the paper that my colleague Anas Alhaji and I did a few years ago was The Future of Cuba's Energy Sector, and I am doing a solo update of that with new data. So I'm going to cite from some of the research coming from this work in progress. One of the things I'd like, again, we were discussing, my fellow panelists and I were discussing, we don't know exactly the composition of the audience here. We have a broad understanding. We don't know the depth and breadth of your understanding. So if I speak above or below your level of understanding of any particular topic, I apologize in advance. Don't want to be assumed too little or assumed too much. Oil was discovered in Cuba, depending on which source that you read, either in the late 19th century or the very early 20th century. But what is known is that commercial production of oil began in the 1930s in Cuba. So it goes back a ways, but not as far back as in the United States. Currently, all Cuban oil that is extracted comes from a very low-quality, high-sulfur crude from onshore wells. And we'll get into offshore in a moment. When I go to Cuba, I spend much of my time in Havana, but I'd like to travel a lot as well. And on one of the trips, I was going out into Matanzas province, and coming back, it just caught my eye that something was different. And I looked at the oil rigs, and they all had Chinese characters on them, whereas before they were in Spanish. And this is the presence of Sinopec. The Chinese are now getting heavily involved. It's not just Venezuela, but China's becoming heavily involved in oil extraction and production, and we should expect to see much more of that. Cuban oil production has fallen over the past 5 years from a high of about 65,000 barrels a day to now about 51,000 barrels a day. The Varadero oil field is nearing the end of its useful life. I talked about that bell-shaped curve, and it is definitely aging. The Varadero, which is the main oil field on the north shores of Cuba, is more than 30 years old. So it will be rapidly depleted and at some point will, quote, run dry. Two other major fields, the Boca de Jarruco and the Puerto de Escondido, likewise are maturing and eventually will dry up. They are not quite as old or as far along as Varadero, though. Currently, Cuba is using about 145,000 barrels of oil a day, down from a high of 2,009 barrels a day, importing now around 100,000 barrels a day from Venezuela. So we see when the Soviets left and the Venezuelans stepped in, the economy is really a false economy. It's one of it's a house of mirrors. It's a house of cards. It's very unstable, and my colleagues, I'm sure, will comment on aspects of this. So with that much oil being imported from Venezuela under its favorable terms, it's really not. It can't sustain itself into the future. Recently, the Cuban oil company, CUPET, revised their estimate of oil reserves in the northern Cuba basin. This is a very recent development, just a matter of weeks old. And whereas before the estimates were around 8 to 10 billion barrels, the estimates are now 20 billion barrels reserves. This would place them in the top 20 in the world as far as oil reserves. They have said that they can back this up with data. The data have not been shared, so I'm still somewhat skeptical of that. But in previous research, my colleague and I did, if you plot the producing wells, the Mexican wells, and the United States wells in the Gulf of Mexico and do a pin plot on there and then look at that big blank space, which is owned by Cuba, it stands to reason, and I'm not a geologist or a petroleum economist, but it stands to reason that there is a higher probability of finding light crude in that area. This is deep sea, and, of course, there are a lot of expenses and cost and other difficulties in extracting this. The U.S. Geological Survey estimated originally about 4.6 billion barrels of crude and 9.8 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in that area. Venezuela has picked up where the Soviets left off in the 80s. They put $136 million in repairs of the Cienfuegos refinery, expecting that to come into production. Significant is the fact that in 1999, Cuba divided up this northern Caribbean basin into 59 tracts and made them open to foreign exploration. The first firms to be granted tracts were Spain, Spain's Repsol YPF, and Canada's Sheritz International. Six were awarded to Spain and four to Canada. Let's see what information West we have here. Currently, Cuba's oil consumption, 68 to 70% of it is going to industry, about 14% into transportation, hopefully somewhat less of that into transportation with the importation recently of the Chinese buses. They are really quite nice, these buses that I'm seeing increasingly on the streets. About 6% of the oil consumption goes to construction, about 5% to residential, and 7% to defense and other government agencies. Those key foreign countries that are involved in exploration now, this is not an exhaustive list, it's a representative list, are Sheritz, as I've mentioned, Repsol, Petrobras from Brazil, and Brazil has really increased the pace and the intensity of their interest in Cuban oil extraction and production, I think somewhat to the chagrin and displeasure of our friend Hugo Chavez. Sinopec China is now definitely involved, and there are other companies, Dutch companies and Norwegian companies that are involved as well. Under any future scenario, and that's what we're talking about, the future of Cuba here, under any future scenario, the Cuban energy sector will grow in both production and consumption. That is my statement. This consumption will increase due to three factors. One, economic growth. The country is positioned to grow with 7% GDP growth in 2007 and possibly even higher growth under new leadership. Economic growth is one of the key three factors. Private ownership growth. That's not a key issue right now, but any transition or succession scenario where we have private ownership by foreign businesses or by the population of the Cuban people, we can see significant growth. And the third is tourism growth. Tourism has fueled a lot of this, and tourism, after dipping a bit last year, is now increasing again. So three factors there. Cuba's energy consumption is positively correlated with economic growth. We just mentioned that economic growth is one of the key factors. This is based on hard data from 1980 to present. There is a linear trend. I don't recall the exact slope of the line. I didn't, if I had brought my PowerPoint, I could show you that. But their energy consumption is understandably positively correlated with GDP growth. Increased openness and the movement toward a free market economy will accelerate such energy consumption. Acceleration in energy consumption is attributable to three factors. Countries in transition experience higher economic growth than companies not in transition. Number two, countries in transition experience faster growth in energy consumption than they do economic growth. And third, growth in energy consumption in Cuba could be higher than other countries in transition because Cuba has one of the lowest rates of per capita energy consumption, per capita electricity consumption, and cars per 1,000 people. Those of you who have visited Cuba and see the traffic on the streets, can you imagine in a few years, we hope, when trade relations are normalized and we have a good government down there, the number of vehicles on the street? It's going to be mind-boggling. Under any future scenario, the potential for Cuba to become a net oil exporter is great. A net oil exporter. For example, Cuba's proven oil reserves are higher than that of Sudan. Currently, it produces only 20% of Sudan's output. Cuban oil is expensive to extract and refine, but it's much closer to world markets. There are many refineries and storage facilities and shipping facilities in the Caribbean that could step in and take this consumption to market. Opportunities for foreign investment. Foreign oil companies will invest. This is my statement, my opinion. Foreign oil companies will invest despite political instability, despite human rights abuses, and despite unilateral sanctions, as they have done in countries such as Algeria, Colombia, Yemen, and Myanmar, just to name a few. History shows us that they will. I predict that Cuba will be capable of producing up to, I say capable, of producing up to 700,000 barrels a day as early as 2015 under any possible scenario. Certainly this would be accelerated if we would see the end to the embargo and Helms-Burton being modified or completely taken off the books. A very conservative estimate is this would require about $10 billion for that to happen. Now, where that money's going to come from, we don't know right now. If Raul's successor makes the right changes, Cuba will be able to attract sufficient foreign investment and develop its energy sector in spite of U.S. sanctions. We are hopeful that with the new administration coming into office that Cuba, the foreign policy toward Cuba will be revisited. We have assurances that it will be. None of us, at least none of I don't know. Maybe Peter knows. He's not sharing. But we don't know exactly how high Cuba will be on the list of priorities for the new president and his administration. But certainly he has made public statements to the effect that he would attempt to engage Cuba under the right conditions. Needed changes. We need to have guaranteed property rights for investors. We need a fair and stable tax system for the Cuban people and for foreign investors. Fiscal and monetary policies must be revised. The wild cards here are currently Venezuela and China. Venezuela has made its pitch, and my opinion is that Hugo Chavez would like to be the heir apparent for leftist leadership in Latin America. Chinese, I think their motives are much different, but their energy is, I think, even greater than that. And, of course, their capabilities are much greater than that of Venezuela. It's also the reason I started with quoting some information about world oil prices is you can imagine how generous President Chavez can be with oil at $147 a barrel. When oil gets to $49, $40, $30 a barrel, everything changes. And as I indicated before, Venezuelans with whom I'm speaking are not pleased with this agreement with Cuba. China has now become Cuba's second largest trading partner, and Chinese exports to Latin America have grown 52% just in the first 9 months of 2008. There's a lot of change in play right now. I wish I had a crystal ball. I don't know what the future holds. I do know that the Cuban people, when I was there just recently, are expecting change from the United States. They're expecting change from their own government. I don't know who will succeed Raul. My opinion is that Raul will not be in office much longer. This isn't an inside line. We don't phone each other up every weekend or anything like that. But from what I know of, by people who know the situation quite well on the ground there, Raul probably does not want to retain leadership. And I believe that succession is already in play. Whether you call it transition or succession, I won't debate semantics with you. But the change is in play right now. There's much, the world markets being in such flux right now certainly is something that makes it even more uncertain. But there's a brief overview of the research that we are doing on energy, in particular the energy sector in Cuba. There are many other, we could talk about biogas and ethanol, sugar production, and so forth, but that's for another time. I think I've just about used up my time, so I will yield the floor, and we'll take questions later. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Terry. Professor Morris?
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very, very much for inviting me. I do have quite a weak voice, and I'm just recovering from a cold, so if my voice doesn't carry, please do gesticulate from the back. Yes, I'm very pleased to be here. I just to quickly say I have been called in the program Dr. Morris and I've been called Professor Morris. And I'm actually not Dr. Morris yet. I've been writing my PhD for 13 years and I'm about to complete it. And in fact, you know, my conclusions have changed over time, and I think now finally the subject of my PhD is the Cuban economy in transition. Question mark or whatever, but I'm looking at the Cuban economy in comparison with, in the context of the whole idea of transition since 1990. I've now got a cut-off date of 2006, but one of the reasons why it's taken me so long is because I've been working for the Economist Intelligence Unit, spending quite a lot of time and energy trying to do, on a monthly basis, trying to do a forecast of what's going to happen to the Cuban economy next, and it's not an easy task. There's quite a lot of work that goes into getting good information on Cuba. I don't know, is that clear enough for you? That good? Okay. The way that I've approached the talk today is to... good. I think what I'd like to do is to look at the trajectory of change from 1990 to now. In order to better understand what are the determinants of the prospects for change today into the future. So it gives you a kind of idea of where I'm coming from. And I think we need to look at it in two aspects. The first I'm going to look at very briefly, actually, is on the political side, on the question of ideology. And we'll come back to that at the end. But what I want to do mainly is actually focus on the economic circumstances that drive change. But just briefly, to look at the ideology, I think that we do have constants. We have something which is, if you like, resistant to change. There is ideology, that the Cuban government is ideologically driven. And the three pillars of their ideology I've called collectivism, basic needs, and sovereignty. Now, that the way that I've expressed their ideology is... reflects the fact that I've been spending a lot of time talking to Cubans. This is how they explain their ideology. The way that we might explain it, or what's more familiar on this side, is to talk about, rather than talk about collectivism, is to talk about the rejection of markets, an anti-market stance. Basic needs, well, we know that they've achieved a lot in terms of keeping their mortality rates low, but we also know that the cost of that has been egalitarianism, which has dampened incentives and so on, and also been opposed to private property and the development of entrepreneurship. And when we talk about sovereignty, possibly what we're also talking about is the survival of the regime. They talk about sovereignty and the survival of the regime are expressed as the same thing. So this is to do with national independence. That's how they express the drive to maintain themselves in power. So collectivism, basic needs and sovereignty, those haven't changed. And I think we could talk about the extent to which, you know, they might be weakened. What we do have now, though, is the changes. And the changes are clearly in the leadership. We have Raoul instead of Fidel. And as Terry also said, Raoul's not going to last all that long. And we also have changes in economic circumstances. Now, what we do know about Raoul is what everybody says about Raoul, and I think it's generally a consensus both here and in Cuba, is that he's more of a pragmatist than his brother. He has less charisma, and therefore he has to work more with people rather than leading from the front. He has to actually build consensus among a team. But we also know that he's launched a national discussion about what's wrong with the Cuban economy, and that was launched properly in 2007, and there was a lot of discussion there. So the Cubans have actually become used to talking about the limitations of their own system in a more open way than hitherto. What happened to that discussion? There was much anticipation of changes that were going to happen at the end of 2007 or during 2008, and not all that much has happened. But nonetheless, I believe that some significant things have happened this year, which we will maybe discuss, and they'll come up in the discussion as we go along. But finally, there's the economic circumstances that have changed, and that's really where the focus of this talk is. And what I want to do here is to look at the changes since 1990 to 91 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and so on, and to look at the overall shape of it. I just want to give four slides I've got, that's all, showing the kind of pattern of change and the proportions and the structure of the economy as it stands. And then finally, I'll just say some brief words about the prospects for change, given the ideology and given the economic circumstances of today. All right, my first slide. First thing I'm going to look at is the external sector, so the external economic circumstances, because the shock to the Cuban economy came from external developments, and in particular from the collapse of the Soviet bloc, which meant that they could no longer sell their sugar at hugely subsidized prices, and they no longer had very cheap finance. And we can see that on this chart here. Now, if you, just in case you can't see the numbers, it goes from 1990 to 2008, and on the left is dollars. These figures are quite good because they're actually all denominated in dollars. The big problem with Cuban data is that the price problem, when you have two different currencies, it's very difficult to compare one compared to the other. But this, we're just talking about international trade, so the data is quite good. And we just see the change in the structure of Cuban foreign exchange. What you have first is sugar earnings. I'm doing it by building up by product, by source of foreign exchange. You can see what happened to sugar. Cuba was enormously dependent on sugar under the Soviet system. The way that the terms of trade, the way that the system worked was to have Cuba specialize in Cuba sugar production, despite its early experimentation and drive to move away. They actually fell back into an increasing dependency on the Soviet bloc and on sugar in particular. Sugar earnings now are tiny. They're 250 million, around that amount today, that's my estimate, compared to 4 billion at the beginning of the period. And there's no sign of a recovery to previous levels. So what have the Cubans done to try to deal with that? The first substitute for sugar, if you like, has been nickel. And there you can see in 2007, 2008, well, particularly 2007, it's very, very high. The price was very, very high of nickel. Fallen again in 2008. interestingly, that the surge in production was from the mid to the late 1990s, but the price wasn't so favourable, so the surge in earnings came later. But in order to achieve that, what the Cubans had to do was to make some very important joint venture contracts with foreign companies. Now, this was one of the important precedents for the economic reforms, a change in the way the Cuban economy worked. And this is primary resources, and they actually sold, if you like, a proportion of their patrimony to the Canadian company, Sherritt, in order to achieve this, in order to have the investment they needed and to have the partner for the refining capacity, which was based in Canada. So there was an important reform that achieved that. The next layer is just tobacco products. You can see it's not hugely important. Cigars are very famous, but they're not actually, what the economy rests on. The next one is medicines. Here again, the amounts aren't huge yet, but I think that what we have here is a potential for future growth that's very strong. And the way that the Cubans are starting to talk, it seems that they've reached a kind of turning point in the production of medicines. Again, they've had to do a lot of learning and changing in the way that they organize their economy in this sense. They've had to learn about intellectual property. They've had to learn about making joint ventures with foreign companies, licensing and contracts and so on. So this has been a learning process for them and has created a new entrepreneurial biotechnology sector, which is an interesting one to watch. Then there's other goods, not a huge amount. And so that's the total amount of goods. And so you can see how earnings have dived in the early 1990s, and they're nowhere near to recovering where they were before in terms of goods exports. To fill the gap, there are services. And the first one to have picked up was tourism. And you can see now by today, earnings, including tourism, have restored to their 1990 level. Tourism, of course, caused a huge cultural shift in terms of economic management, in terms of culture, in terms of acceptance of foreigners coming again and waiting on foreigners and joint ventures in order to get capital, to get marketing. The development of a whole generation now of managers of hotels who think very, very differently from their predecessors who used to work in state companies. And finally, the other services. And there you see other services, very important this one, had expanded up until 2004 but then took off. That takeoff is the Venezuela factor mainly. And so you see the huge surge in foreign exchange earnings, which is mainly responsible for the surge in GDP growth over the last few years. Those earnings, I've had to play with the figures a little bit there because the foreign accounts include actually more than I have there for earnings from other services, but then include also a large outflow in terms of transfers. So there are two things happening there. One is how much Chavez pays for the doctors and professionals that go to Venezuela and to the other countries. And the other one is Cuba's free donation of similar services to third countries. So here I've got the net earnings, what they actually earn from services. And you can see that that's caused that huge lift. If we add then net current transfers, which includes remittances, and I know there's a big discussion within the United States about remittances and how important they are for Cuba, I think it's important to see their size compared to everything else. They're not that huge. Moreover, those net current transfers include not only remittances from the United States, but remittances from other places too. And so you've had a large increase in tourism, foreign visitors, and so on, which has also contributed to incoming transfers there. And finally, you have the size of financing. Now, this is a derived figure. Cubans don't actually have a figure as such. What we do have is the figure for changes in reserves for some of those years, the figures for the current account deficit. And from that, you can put together this picture of how much foreign finance has arrived in Cuba over that period. And you can see that an important part of the Soviet support at the beginning was this cheap finance. That disappeared completely in the mid-1990s. And it's picked up, but it's still not huge. So if we look at... So that's the pattern during that period. That pickup in financing is a reflection of the opening to foreign direct investment in the 1990s. And I think since 2004, it's not so much the opening to foreign private investment as official financing from sympathetic countries, being Venezuela, also China. So it's officially backed finance from China. And these have been important parts of the total sum. I don't have a full breakdown, but you can see that there's been a slight change in the composition of financing. So whereas during the 90s it was a shift towards the private sector, in the past few years it's been a shift towards official negotiations. So all of that leaves us here in 2008. That's the same, that's the bar that we had at the end of the last chart. That's no different. So that's the change in the composition. And so that the question there is, what are the imperatives for change? Given that that's the composition, which are the most important, and what are the kind of things that the economists within the government and the economists advising those within the government are thinking about that they should be doing? And if we take those items one by one, the options that are available to Cuba to continue its growth on the external sector. First of all, the question of sugar. I think that people talk about sugar, they don't realise how small sugar is as a proportion of the total. It is not central to Cuba's future. I was interested when the hurricanes happened, there were reports, you know, this proportion of sugar has been flattened, you know, the Cuban economy is finished. It doesn't follow. You know, the sugar could disappear and it wouldn't make a huge amount of difference anymore. What it does do, it has quite a large number of people are employed there, although it's half as many as there were in 2002. So it's a slimmer industry now. It's been, the number of personnel has been reduced. And so there's a whole discussion about opening again now to foreign investment. And I think the opportunities are there now where they weren't before, because previously one of the principles on which, you know, foreign economic policy was hung was the idea that the government has an obligation to guarantee full employment. And so the problem with having foreign investors in sugar is that the first thing they'd come and do is to lay off lots of workers because it was hugely overmanned. And so we have a slimmer industry, and so you do have more potential for foreign investment, I think, in there to that extent. Second, nickel. Nickel is much duller than it used to be because of the collapse of the price this year. In the Dominican Republic, they've actually closed down the main nickel mine. In Cuba, they haven't closed any down. Apparently, Cuban nickel has a low production cost, and so it's profitable for longer than other places. But certainly, the investment plans that have been there for increasing output in the next few years, I just adjusted my forecast, actually, this current month, in the light of the collapse of prices. It means that I'm sure that investments won't be made at the speed that they were intended before. There'll be a review there. Tobacco, really, the tobacco market is pretty mature. We know it's not a good thing to be in today's world. And even if you're doing premium cigars, and even if there were a US market which might double the size of it, it's still not a growing industry beyond that one leap. And it's one that I suppose the Dominican Republic would be nervous about, Cuba's position in the US market. If we move on then to medicines, I do think that there is some kind of buzz about medicines. There's new investment going into productive capacity within Cuba, even though part of what they're doing is licensed production abroad, so that won't appear in these figures. But they also seem to be increasing capacity within Cuba. So that could be a takeoff industry. But as you can see, it's actually quite small still now. Other goods, the question there is the scope for them. While there is no trade with the US, the scope for assembly industries or the kind of manufacturing that other countries in the region do is pretty limited. The Cubans did try free trade zones in the 1990s, and then they quietly abandoned them because nothing happened. There wasn't much going on. The other thing is that Cubans have imposed minimum wage costs, which are relatively high. I say wage costs rather than salaries because there's a separation between the two. So the question is, to what extent would there be scope with or without the US market? That's a critical issue for the Cubans. Possibly there would be scope if the US market opened up, But as it is, I don't think there's that much that can happen there. On tourism, we know that there's hard times now. We're expecting, and my forecast anticipates no growth next year. And I think that's possibly quite optimistic given the state of the OECD economies. The big issue there, big unknown, is whether or not there'd be a US market for tourism. The number of tourists visiting Cuba at the moment per year is about 2 million, just over. And the estimates suggest that within 1 year you might have a million tourists from the US visiting Cuba. And you can see that's a big impact on the industry, a one-off jump. But my forecast doesn't assume that that will be opened. We can discuss that. It assumes that possibly the Cuban Americans will be travelling there more easily, but not tourists. Other services. Now, we've already seen a slowdown in other services from Cuba. The Venezuelan market isn't expanding as much as it did before. The oil price has fallen. We can't really expect that much growth to come from there anymore. What the Cubans have done, interestingly, they've been talking to a lot of other countries about collaboration in the medical field, in medical education, in medical building up medical capacity, and so on. And so it does seem that there's some possibilities there, and particularly with China. And Chinese, we know, are now thinking of pump priming their economy with state investment in the health sector, and the Cubans have actually got expertise in building capacity there, and I think that's something that's going on there. But whether or not they can maintain even that level of earnings is open to question. And then finally, remittances. I think we can expect more from the US, but I don't think it's ever going to be, possibly. I mean, in the short term, and anyway, my assumption is it won't be growing to the size that it is in some of the countries in the region as a proportion of total inflows. Finally, on finance, I put OECD or not, because a lot of the finance, as I said, is actually coming from China or from Venezuela or from Brazil, which are non-OECD countries. And this can be quite confusing in some of the data, because most of the data about flows of finance tend to be from rich countries to poor countries. So if you have the Paris Club figures or if you have the BIS figures and so on, they're always like that. And so they exclude Venezuela, Brazil, China as donors. And so you have to be careful with the numbers. Recently, as I said, it's been coming from outside the OECD. Finance from the OECD is very difficult for Cuba to secure, partly because of the deterrent effect of US sanctions and the threat of US sanctions on lenders, on financial institutions in, for example, the United Kingdom, in Europe, and so on. And so a change in stance in the US could actually have quite an interesting impact on the cost and availability of finance for Cuba. Okay, now I'm going to move from the external to the domestic, and I realise I need to go quite fast. If we've got a lot of change on the external side, huge changes, huge cultural changes, huge changes in the economic system, a move towards world market prices, actually an integration with the world market, if you like. This has been a kind of a liberalisation. And the domestic economy, it's not. And if we look at GDP growth over that period, there's the size of GDP with the index number starting at 100 in 1990. You see the slump to 1993 to 4, and then the recovery since. That's GDP. Now, if you look at agriculture, nowhere near its 1990 level. Manufacturing, not much better. Well, industry, not much better, despite the fact that oil production has increased and nickel production has increased. Industry still remains depressed. And then you have a huge increase in services. So the proportion of GDP that is accounted for by services is bigger than ever in Cuba. And there is concern because there's a high import propensity now in Cuba. They don't seem to be able to substitute for imports. And that's a discussion among economists now. How do we increase capacity domestically? And it's led to interesting discussions, for example, in agriculture, about possibly private agriculture is more productive than state agriculture because there's this thing about how hard people work when they have their own farm compared to how hard people work in the state. But it's more than that. It's also a discussion about prices because you have such huge distortions in prices in agriculture. People can't get enough to pay for their inputs because the state buys at a low price. And so there's a whole review about prices. And that brings us actually... Oh, to the next slide. But yeah, so we had reforms over the period, important reforms in the agro markets. I don't know if you've come across perfeccionamiento, which is restructuring of businesses, to move them towards more conventional profit and loss ways of working. There's been very important changes in the financial system and in the system of auditing. And now we have the land redistribution, which is in process as we speak. We have a very small opening to self-employment, which is interesting because that's actually one of the most restricted areas. There's this ideological resistance to private enterprise. But nonetheless, we have had a big expansion of joint ventures with foreign companies, and that's created a kind of strange contradictions there. But I would argue, and I that one of the biggest problems in the Cuban economy now is the dualism. There are two different exchange rates, at least two, but now there's a Cuban peso and the convertible peso. One's a cuc and one's a cup, or other names that the Cubans call them on the street. And what you had is during the economic crisis of the early 90s, you had a very steep collapse in the value of the Cuban peso relative to the dollar. So I've done this relative to the dollar here. And you can see it's not recovered to anywhere near its previous level. And you have this undervalued Cuban peso and a whole set of prices within the peso economy, many of which are controlled by the state and have been held well, well lower than their market level. And then you have the external sector, the what used to be known as a dollar shop, the divisa shop, where prices move more towards the world market. And between those two, you just have so much scope for illegal black market activity that you have this enormous illegal economy, and you have a very distorted market in which private entrepreneurs operate. So if you liberalize, if you have self-employment, the self-employed person can get a lot more by arbitrating between those two markets than they can by working efficiently or whatever. And so I think one of the important restrictions, the blockages, obstacles to liberalization is actually prices and the exchange rate. And I think the Cubans actually think that as well. It seems to me, talking to the people at the central bank, they're trying to work out how they can bring the two economies closer together. And I think when that happens, then you have much more scope for the growth and development and liberalization of the domestic economy. There we are. So to conclude, first of all, in terms of ideology, we've had the principles, the key unchanging principles have actually been tempered by what, it's not my term, somebody has called ad hocism, which is, they attribute to a kind of way of doing things that was inherited from guerrilla warfare or whatever. But it's you respond to things as the problems as they come, to the immediate constraints that there are. And so on the external economy, this ad hoc response has involved actually a huge amount of reform. On the internal economy, less so. But there's now, we know that there's greater pragmatism than there was before, but we also know that the constants still remain, and I don't think that you should underestimate the resistance to change that there still exists within the leadership. And I put that no surrender because as a British person, that's a familiar slogan from Northern Ireland, and I think that that precedent is quite an interesting one. You had this no surrender on both sides, but in fact they finally found a way to agree without any of them surrendering. And I think that, you know, the principle is no surrender, but if you factor in ad hocism, you can see that there might be ways around it. The circumstances today, on the domestic side, we have stagnation and dualism. These are acute problems. If anybody who travels to Cuba can see, it just stares you in the face. It's a frustration every day. It's, you know, there is a petition that's been made up by the dissidents about, you know, demanding an end to the dual economy. Well, it's interesting because the people in the central bank actually have exactly the same objective. And in fact, the government has said the same. It's not an easy thing to do. And externally, there's a continual search for new sources of growth, and I think that that will lead to further evolution. And the big one that would lead to more than evolution, but a leap, would be a change in terms of liberalization of trade and economic relations between Cuba and the United States. And that's where I'm going to leave it with two question marks there at the end, because all I've done is I haven't said exactly what the prospects for change are, but I think that what I've done is open up a whole load of questions for you to think about. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Emily. Professor Ritter?
I'm always relieved when the PowerPoint gets started. Well, I'm very happy to be here. It's exciting to be in Washington amid the buzz that's going on here. And actually, it's very nice to leave Ottawa for two reasons. First, climate, which you're well aware of. But secondly, we have a little political crisis going on, a constitutional crisis, very strange phenomena. We don't know what the government's going to be as of next Friday, this Friday, but we'll see. Well, I'm going to speak on Cuba's current problems and its alternate economic futures. Basically, I'm going to look at the changed international context in which Cuba is riding high. I'm going to say a few words about its new development strategy and the changed economic leadership. A few words then on the major economic challenges and then alternate scenarios for Cuba's future. Here's a basic summary, which I'll go over, of the changed international context. That's it, but I'll go over it bit by bit. You all know about the role of Venezuela in Cuba, which is overwhelming at this point. That is in jeopardy with the lower oil prices. In Latin America, Cuba has cultivated very positive relationships with the Axis, with Hugo Evo and Daniel Ortega. With the social democrat countries, there's a picture of Lula with Raul. And Cuba has used medical aid very, very effectively to build political support in Latin America and in parts of Africa. China, as you know, there's a very productive relationship with China. There's a very interesting relationship with Russia. By the way, and you all have seen the visit of Medvedev in Cuba. There is a picture of the new Orthodox Church in Old Havana, which was Fidel's idiosyncratic project. And I'm not sure why he did it, and the Cubans don't have much idea why he did it, but adding to the old Havana Disneyland is a Russian Orthodox Church at this point. Big surprise. Cuba is in the process of joining the Rio Group. Its relations with Africa are very good, and it has it celebrates trade deals with many, many countries in the world. In the United Nations, Cuba is riding high, I would say. They have operated very effectively, I would say basically subverting the basic objectives of the Human Rights Commission. They win the votes overwhelmingly concerning the embargo. Their Minister of Foreign Relations seems to work very well. And in the past, I think they very successfully sort of repaired the damages that President Castro generated. So Cuba is doing very well in the international context. With respect to its trading partners, its trading relationships have changed dramatically. Venezuela and China, the big trading partners, as you can see there. United States, a significant trading partner. And the old countries that were pretty dominant earlier, Spain, Canada, and Holland, which imports nickel, they are... of lesser significance at this time. More numbers, which I'll skip. One interesting thing from Canada's perspective is how quickly the Cubans dropped Canada as a source of agricultural imports and switched to the United States. And Canada had always thought that we would be cultivating long-term benefits from our relationship with Cuba, but very quickly, when the time came, the Cubans bought where the price was right, and I think there were political factors involved, and Canada was overwhelmed by the United States as a source of food imports. Well, looking at the new development strategy, I would say that the development strategies, I've got a summary of the past strategies, which I won't say anything about, But starting in about 2005, I would say there has been a new approach, which differs very markedly from the development strategy of the special period. In the special period, tourism, remittances, nickel were the important sectors, and sugar, they were giving up on sugar. However, what has happened since is that services and resources have become the major sources of foreign exchange, as Emily emphasized. Medical services, that whole project is very well launched. Cuba earns lots of foreign exchange from its doctors and medical personnel abroad. Medical tourism in Cuba is significant. And biotechnological pharmaceutical exports are very important. So that is a central leg of the foreign exchange component of the new strategy. Nickel, another important component. Major expansions were planned, but as Emily mentioned, they may be up in the air due to nickel prices in the last year and a half. Petroleum and extraction and production. You can see the North Cuban Basin. And you can see the little logos of the various companies involved there. But it does appear that Cuba has and can extract large amounts of petroleum at very high cost in that area. And with lower petroleum prices, it will be interesting to see what these companies do with respect to their longer-term plans, whether they'll hold on waiting for the price of oil to bounce back or not. Tourism. We've seen that already. Tourist expenditures have increased. I don't think they've peaked at all. I think normalization with the United States will lead to a massive explosion of curiosity tourism, family reunification tourism, conference tourism, etc., etc. But tourism has been a very successful source. Sugar. Cuba's forgetting it. I think it's a major mistake. But it may come back with Brazilian participation in ethanol production. Remittances will continue, and I think they will also increase when Obama lifts the limits on the amounts of money that can be sent in. So from the foreign exchange perspective, I think the new strategy emphasizing services mainly is looking reasonable for Cuba with lots of question marks. They've diversified their sources of foreign exchange, and I think that the foreign exchange earnings will help generate economic growth within Cuba. Here, we've seen this already, but this emphasizes how significant professional services and tourism are as sources of foreign exchange compared to sugar, which is where is sugar? Oh, agri-food is sugar, sorry. Thought I'd forgotten it. The second leg of Cuba's strategy is a knowledge economy and society. And Cuba has, in the last 4 to 5, 6 years, expanded higher education very remarkably. They've established a university for computational sciences, IT, and they were talking about doing in education what they had been doing in medicine. That is becoming a major exporter of educational services, and they are launched on that, but in a more nascent, a more preliminary way. However, the unintended consequence of all of this is the emergence of an IT underground, which is very interesting. And some of you may have heard of Yoani Sanchez, who was the first Cuban blogger, actually she's one of my heroines, but with great courage and great intelligence, she launched a blog inside the controlled information technology system, and it's a work of art. And she, as a mother at home, she describes life as she sees it. But the IT sector, I think, will generate some interesting unintended consequences that we're starting to see. I'll skip this. Oh, here is just a chart on Cuban growth rates. You can see the contraction in the first years, sort of a halting recovery in the mid-90s, rapid recovery, according to Cuban statistical measures, in the 2000s. And I would estimate for this year, And last year, a decline in the growth rate. And next year, I think it will probably be lower still because of the foreign exchange earning issue. New economic leadership, question mark. Is there new economic leadership? Well, in a certain sense, yes, because Castro is not there to micromanage the situation. His brother, Raul, is in charge. Raul is more pragmatic, as we have seen over quite a few years. Here's the new economic team. And we see their continuity. These people, that's Raul. That's José Luis Rodríguez. That's Laje. That's Alarcón. And who is this guy? Help me on this. Who? I've forgotten his name, I'm sorry. But that's the economic team, basically. And it emphasizes the continuity in the functioning of the Cuban economy. These people are all older as well, so there's going to be a generational change soon. For a while, it was thought that Fidel would continue to manage things from behind the scenes, from his hospital bed. That does not seem to be happening. Fidel is reduced to writing reflexiones, for which he gets front-page treatment in the newspapers. His comments seem to be increasingly irrelevant. Raul seems to be increasingly his own man. At least that's my reading of the situation. So Fidel, I think, is increasingly out of the picture. Well, here are the main economic challenges, or some of the main economic challenges. Demographic, the living standards issue, agriculture, infrastructure, internal apertura, money and exchange rate reform, which I won't discuss, and democracy and human rights, which is an economic as well as political issue. Demography. This is an interesting chart. This shows the total fertility rate, which is the number of children per woman. This is the net fertility rate, the number of daughters per woman. You can see that Cuba's record with respect to fertility rates is very much like the countries of Europe. The fertility rate has fallen to below 2.2, which is the level for population stability. So the Cubans are not reproducing themselves. Here's the population pyramid for the country. And you can see the huge cohorts here that were born just after the revolution when the economic conditions improved. Since then, this declining fertility rate has led to a shrinkage at the bottom of the population pyramid. And you can see very quickly that an aging population is going to become a dying population because when these cohorts hit 60 to 85, the population is going to decline rapidly. In fact, the population has already started to decline. Last year, it was in decline partly due to emigration as well as the aging and dying of the population. So that's going to be a longer-term issue for Cuba. This is a picture of real wage and income levels. You see the nominal wage, which from 1989 to the present has risen, but that is the old Cuban peso wage. If you try and calculate a real wage from that, you can see a huge decline immediately following the economic meltdown, and you see a gradual increase. But they are nowhere near where the situation was in 1989. Now, this isn't a totally accurate picture because people have other sources of income, such as the underground economy and remittances. But this is the picture of wages. And I'm going to skip that. Agriculture, continuing problems. The sugar agro-industry has collapsed. The attempt to replace that with diversified crops has been very disappointing. There's some minor successes. There are a lot of attention is given to urban agriculture, which is interesting. Organic agriculture, a lot of hype about that. But nutritional levels have improved. I'd say they've improved mainly because of increased imports of foodstuffs. Here's a chart which shows the agricultural situation. The green columns show agricultural exports in different years, the red agricultural imports. You can see here that Cuba has changed from the 50s or the mid-70s from being a very significant agricultural exporter, net agricultural exporter, to being a huge agricultural importer. That's bad news for Cuba. And I'm going to skip that one as well. Infrastructure. Many of you have heard about Cuba's infrastructure problems. And if when you visit Cuba, you get outside of the old Havana tourist Disneyland, you very quickly see the lack of maintenance for 50 years, and especially for the last 15 or 20 years. But the infrastructure problems are serious. Housing, perhaps, the most serious. Here's just a list of some of them, but water systems, plumbing, sewage systems, electrical systems in general and in people's homes are problematic. Actually, that electrical system there looks a little bit like my house. Transportation infrastructure is problematic. And here are just some pictures of the transportation system. But here's the new Chinese bus. And the transportation system is improving with the importation of these articulated buses replacing the old camellos. This is the water system. The water system in Havana is very bad. The UN statistics indicate 100% access to water, but in fact, it's very difficult for people to get water in their homes. Often they have to travel to a communal tap, carry water in pails up the flights of stairs in their apartments and so on. I'm going to skip that one. This is a picture of a market and another one. And this is interesting. This says, "Thank you, Fidel, for all you have done for us." Another issue of importance in Cuba is called by many people the internal economic apertura. It's very important from a crass economistic standpoint to have a free press. One needs criticism. One needs people watching what's going on, able to criticize and suggest improvements. That has been a disadvantage for Cuba for a long time. One interesting thing we have seen is some economic reporting that is more frank than we've seen in the past, and there have been very interesting articles in Juventud Rebelde, which have been very critical of the economy. That's a good sign. Then there is institutionalized secrecy and some basic economic measurement. We don't know how GDP is measured. We don't know how they translate the part of GDP that is generated in dollars and the part of GDP in pesos into some sort of common measure. I've never seen how that's been done, and the Cubans can't explain that. Here is a major one. Cubans are very, very entrepreneurial, and they have had to be. That has been cultivated in them over the last 50 years. This is a strange paradox of the revolution. Cuba's tried to create the new socialist man. They've created a nation of entrepreneurs. Why? Well, the reason is that people have to scramble and make ends meet on their own. This is necessary for basic survival. So when Cubans leave Cuba, they take those same habits and become successful quite quickly. Not all, but disproportionately. Well, micro-enterprise exists, but it is controlled very tightly. It's restricted by licensing, by prohibitions of various sorts. There's no access to credit, no access to foreign exchange. They can't use intermediaries, limits on employees, and lots of petty restrictions, such as the 12 chairs in a restaurant. You've all heard about those. Taxation is onerous. All professional activities are prohibited from the private sector. So small enterprises exists, but it is constrained and limited very sharply. Taxation. I don't have time to go into this, but if I were a Cuban, I would be really angry because the foreign joint ventures get sort of a standard international type of taxation, But the micro enterprises get the taxation boots put to them very sharply. Taxation, they're not allowed to deduct costs or investment expenses from revenues in calculating net revenue and pay tax on the net revenue, which is very, very bizarre. So, I don't have time to go over all of the other components, but the tax regime for microenterprise is designed to control them, constrain them very, very sharply. Well, the consequences for the limits on small enterprise are very serious. Product diversity is limited. Efficient job creation is blocked. The underground economy expands because when people can't get licenses, they do what they can underground. These enterprises are often very inefficient because they are forced to remain so small. So one could say that the resources of Cuba, the human natural capital resources, are wasted. They're sent down the tubes by this policy. This affects the day-to-day life of people. It creates a contempt for the law because people, when the law is silly, they disregard it and they feel no remorse whatsoever. And not only that, innovation in the economy is blocked. And I don't have time to elaborate on that, but in many sectors of an economy, high-tech and low-tech, innovation is brought about by people getting good ideas, spinning off, and undertaking those activities. Well, that can't happen in Cuba. I'm going to skip that, but maybe not. One interesting thing in Cuba is that in an area where entrepreneurship was liberalized, namely artisan and crafts work, there was an explosion of entrepreneurial and artistic creativity, which one can see in the artisan markets of Cuba. And my theory is that if they liberalized in all small business, micro-enterprise areas, they would see a similar explosion of creativity and a very, very interesting small enterprise. Okay, last part of the presentation. Peter, I'm sorry, I'm programmed to speak in 50-minute blocks, eh? But I'll try and be fast. Okay, I looked at five alternate scenarios here. Status quo, modified status quo, something that I've called the petroleum party patronage paradigm, and forgive the alliteration, the Chinese model, and then the Irish model. And I'm going to look at each of one of those, and I have the probabilities of those occurring in the next time periods. And you can see, just to jump to the conclusion, that the modified status quo looks to be the most probable for the next 5 years. Some petroleum party patronage system after that, but ultimately the Irish good luck model. Okay, the status quo. For it to be maintained, I see that as being unlikely. I think we will see further small changes. If Fidel were to die tomorrow and Armando Hart were put in the presidency, then we might see the status quo being continued, but I don't think that'll happen. All sorts of disadvantageous consequences would occur from a pure status quo. The modified status quo is where we are at this time. There have been, the current prime minister, president, of course, is Raul Castro, but we've seen the possibilities for change. We've seen an opening to some economic criticism. We've seen some tolerance for some opposition, more than in the past at any rate. Hints concerning exchange rate change, hints concerning micro-enterprise liberalization, and hints with respect to foreign investment. Hints. The reforms so far, I would say most of them are not that significant, except that they remove major humiliations faced by the Cuban citizens. For example, many times I've been with Cubans, and they have problems going to a tourist hotel with me. So some of these changes I don't think are that significant. A major change that has been significant so far is the provision of 10-year renewable leases to small farmers. So this is sort of a partial privatization occurring in agriculture. That, I think, is the most significant change that seems to be in operation under Raul so far. The consequences of this modified status quo, well, some economic improvement. What will happen to unrest, I'm not sure, but it may well be that rising expectations generate rising dissatisfaction. Okay, if Cuba becomes a major petroleum power, which now looks increasingly probable, at least if petroleum prices bounce back to $100 a barrel, then I think we could see in 10 or 15 years major phenomena occurring. I think if the current regime lasts till the year 2015, it's going to be flush with petroleum revenues. That is going to strengthen its economic hand immensely. If that were the case, then one could imagine only modest economic reforms. And Cuba wouldn't have to worry about normalizing with the United States. In fact, I don't think it worries that much about it in any case. Well, the consequences of this phenomenon would be that Cuba, like Venezuela, would be afflicted by the curse of resource wealth. I'm running out of time. Political implications, I think, would be that the resource revenues would feed the party patronage machine and strengthen the political status quo. Potential president there, Felipe Roque. The Chinese model. Could Cuba maintain its political system but open the economy to foreign investment and marketize the economy? Could it become a Caribbean dragon? Well, maybe. The consequences also strengthen party control, no authentic democratization, continuing repression, but that would be combined with economic prosperity and certain economic liberties in some areas. The possible president, Carlos Laje. And here, the Irish model. Could Cuba, also an offshore island, follow Ireland's example? Ireland became a Celtic tiger, so to speak. It surpassed Britain, its old colonial master in terms of income per capita and in terms of the human development index. So they have been very, very successful in the last 10 or 15 years. Could Cuba do similar things in terms of opening up to trade and foreign investment and achieve similar types of prosperity? Well, these are the main features of the Irish model that one would think might be relevant for Cuba. Democratization, gateway. Ireland is a gateway to Europe for American enterprises. Cuba could be a gateway to Latin America. Economic integration, productive relations with the diaspora, internal economic liberalization, and so on. Well, the probability of this, I would say, in the short run is very, very low. In the longer term, I would say the probability is a whole lot higher. So who might be the president there? Well, I wish any one of these could be president, eh? Elizardo Sanchez, Oscar Paya, or Yoani Sanchez. And I don't have time to discuss them in person. So this is my conclusion again. Basically, I think for the next 5 years, we're likely to remain in the modified status quo, even given a succession after Raul's death, if he dies in that time period. Following that, we may well see the petroleum party patronage becoming the most probable. But ultimately, I think Cuba will turn towards what I've called here the Irish model. So I'm going to skip this, I think. I've run out of time. My conclusion, in the short run, I'm pessimistic concerning major political and economic change. In the long term, I'm more optimistic. Well, what are my reasons? I think one is the entrepreneurship, the good education of the Cuban people. The quality of human capital, so to speak, is very high. Mother Nature, Cuba has a good resource endowment, agriculturally, minerally, location, and so on, but also wishful thinking. Okay, this is Cuba's human capital, natural capital, so thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Arch. These have been extraordinarily interesting presentations. I'm sure there's there are many questions, we will extend our session to about quarter of to allow for some questions. The floor is open. Please state your name and your affiliation when you ask your question. Sir.
On what changes do you expect in an Obama administration? I mean, there have been a lot of ideas floated. And so what kind of change do you expect and the impact in Cuba? And also, I had the impression that you foresee perhaps a medium-term good future for Cuba in the oil sector. I mean, are you forecasting sort of a big leap in the economic terms for Cuba from the oil sector? Thank you.
Okay. Hey, I'm a Canadian. What do I know about Obama's policies? But it does look from what he said that remittances will be permitted to enter Cuba without limit, and that family reunification travel among Cuban Americans will occur without hindrance. Those are sort of very minimalist types of policy changes. My guess is that very quickly the Obama administration will do much more, and I would see such things as removing Cuba from the list of terrorist countries, which is an irritant. I would see better treatment for the diplomatic corps of both groups of countries, also an irritant. I would see eventually a lifting of the embargo, and I hope in the next 8 years to see just a normalization, a complete normalization of the relationship between the United States and Cuba. So I think it will happen. It might happen more slowly than some of us might wish. And shall I answer the second part?
No. Why don't we focus on?
Okay. Again, you know, I partly came here because I wanted to hear what people said about what Obama might be doing. But from the Cuban point of view, there is also the easing up. I agree that the things like travel for Cuban Americans, remittances, and reversing some of the additional restrictions on the one-way trade that is currently permitted are probably quite likely. I think the thing to watch, and I'm not as optimistic as you for the medium term, I'm afraid, because that both sides have now said that they're prepared to talk to each other, in principle, but the conditions that they impose are very different. On the US side, they say they will talk, but there will always be conditions, and it's part of the process of democratization. On the Cuban side, they said they will talk, but only without conditions. And it's trying to reach a form of words and a way to get over that obstacle, which I think is a critical one to watch. And it seems to me that it is possible that you have normalization. It's also possible that you can carry on like this for another 50 years. And so I think that's the one to watch. In the coming year, it will start to emerge. In my forecast, I've actually got a slight liberalization, but not a normalization.
Okay. Well, I think my colleagues have covered the first half of the question quite well, so let me comment on the second half. I think, and Arch alluded to this in his paradigm, I think petroleum is going to play a major role in the near-term future. Whether or not the Cuban estimates of the reserves in the North Caribbean basin are reliable or not, we can't say. I always consider Cuban data somewhat suspect. But I think there is potential for petroleum, oil in particular, to play a factor in the succession transition to a new administration in Cuba. Also was alluded to, but we didn't go into any kind of depth, on sugar. We agree that sugar has fallen on hard times. It's really flat right now. There was a hint that it could be used for ethanol, and I think that was understated. I think the possible future for the Cuban sugar industry to get back on its feet, maybe not to previous levels, but engaged in ethanol, because ethanol production with sugar byproducts is far cheaper than it is with corn.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen here, question? No? Yeah. Did you have a question, sir?
Yeah.
All right. Here's the microphone now.
Lorenzo Perez, IMF and ASCII. I was interested to see the sharp increase in the earnings of services. And the question I have is, any of you have any notion that might contain an element of economic aid from Venezuela to Cuba? In other words, is Venezuela paying market prices for the services or not?
Quickly. Yeah, that is a discussion, and certainly, you know, if you work out what they say that they've earned and you try to divide that by the number of doctors, it seems like they're paying an awful lot. But then some of the questions that then are raised are they talking about all of the doctors or the doctors just to Venezuela and so on? I think there's also possibly, although I haven't got the details of it because it's not a transparent transaction, is that the agreement was to have the price of doctors and the price of oil linked to each other. So as Cuba pays less for its oil, it will also earn less for its doctors. So what it provides is a kind of insulation against oil price fluctuations. So aid, you could call it, but a lot of countries sell goods at prices other than the world market price. It's not the only case. And so, yes, there's favorable terms of trade, I'd say, possibly involved.
Philip Hughes from the White House Writers Group. I wanted to dolly back from all three presentations and test an observation on the panelists, because it seemed to me that what particularly Ms. Morris's longitudinal economic data showed is that Cuba's economy is a complete artificiality. It was a complete artificiality in the Soviet period when subsidized sugar prices propped up the economy in the way that her figures describe. And it's a significant artificiality now between the subsidy to energy consumption that Professor Morris pointed out and this unaccountable, huge 40% of the external sector earnings from, quote, services, which presumably are mostly doctors sent to Venezuela, not to mention, of course, the fortuitous prices that have primary products like nickel have commanded until recently in the world market. Now, a lot of that artificiality is based, according to what you were saying, on favorable terms from sympathetic countries, China, Venezuela, including in financing. Well, how does this all work, then, looking to the future? A highly artificial economy has difficulty making a transition to the real world, and a highly artificial political system that makes a transition to the real world by, say, democratizing, might not be treated the same way by those sympathetic countries. So could you maybe net that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, those figures do show that the support that came from the Soviet Union and the support that comes from Venezuela. What's interesting is the middle part, Cuba had actually the hardest budget constraint of any transition economy. It didn't have favorable finance that all of the other transition economies had. So in a sense, and if you're talking about Caribbean economies, let's look at the Caribbean economies and see how artificial their arrangements are with their bilateral trade deals with the United States, with their harnessing tax rules elsewhere. I mean, you know, small economies very often survive on some kind of bilaterally arranged, you know, price or trade deal. And so Cuba's no different in that way. I think that it's exaggerated, its dependence on Venezuela. Clearly, politically, they love doing it. Chavez loves doing it, and Castro loved doing it. I don't think that the Cuban economy is entirely now dependent on Venezuela. Certainly, if you look at its relations with Venezuela, economic relations with Venezuela compared to economic relations with the Soviet bloc, they're a much more minor part of it. It's about 20-25%, whereas with the Soviet bloc, it was you know, over 90. That is a factor, and you know, politics is a factor in Cuba's future, without a doubt.
Just a quick comment. I would agree that Cuba is vulnerable in the future, and I think some Cubans recognize their vulnerability. They're not as vulnerable as they were in the Soviet era, and the end of all the hidden subsidization led to that, to just an incredible economic meltdown. They are less reliant on hidden assistance from Venezuela, but I think if that hidden assistance, those special deals in oil and doctors, if those were to disappear overnight, that would hurt Cuba badly. The question in my mind is, how sustainable are these in the long run? I think they'll continue for quite a while, but in the long run, 10, 15 years, Venezuela will have its own medical capacity. Cuba can perhaps provide these services to Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, or some African countries. So it may be a reasonable source of foreign exchange earnings for Cuba, the medical services, for regions in Africa, but I don't think that Venezuela is going to be in a position to finance those in future.
Thank you very much. Gentleman in the back.
What explains that
could
we...
Could you identify yourself, please, sir? In your
Oscar Echevarria, Global Hispanic. What explains that with the success of China and Vietnam of combining political control and stability, so the leadership, but at the same time, more economic freedom and better standard of living, so much so that China, we have a GDP per capita in 59 or 1/6 of Cuba, have now 6 times or 7 times that much. The Cuban leadership doesn't imitate the Chinese or Vietnamese model.
Okay. Sure. I think there are some similarities to both models. Personally, I think that they're following or attempting to follow the Chinese model more than the Vietnamese model. China certainly has been a much larger partner, of course, but a much more willing partner. It's purely anecdotal, but I know Arch will find when he goes to Havana in a few days, as I found when I was there last week, the mere Chinese presence, every time I go, I see it more and more and more. The hotels I stay in, meetings I attend, the folks you see on the streets. China has a plan. Well, not to say that most countries don't, but China has a very concerted and definitive plan for world investment, and particularly where Latin America is concerned. Their exports to Latin America last year have risen dramatically, and I think their model is going to be more palatable and a little bit a better fit than the Vietnamese model. You know, the countries are quite different in size, and I don't think that Cuba has the capacity to become like China. That's we're talking, an elephant and an ant here. The Cuban economy is significant, but it is not anywhere near that of the.
Yeah.
Okay, how redirect it? Oh.
Improving, while the political elite maintains control.
Well,
so I'm not. Nobody will pretend Cuba will be another China.
Right. But okay, in my opinion, I contend that the reforms in Cuba, maybe we disagree on the extent and the effect of reforms in China. Rather, I think the reforms that you speak of, and I don't know exactly how you articulate them in your mind, are maybe not as dramatic as you believe them to be. I don't find that reform in Cuba. I keep saying Cuba, and China has been that significant. There are many conditions there, the working conditions. Help me understand. Okay. Sure.
I think there's a lot of difference between Cuba and China. I think it is interesting that when the president of China came over, there were articles in the press about the Chinese model of socialism in Cuba and a more favorable discussion of it. I think that's part of the discussion within Cuba. It's part of the reason why they're talking about reforms. And so I do think that, they are trying to now, there's the ideological resistance, but there's a big discussion going on within Cuba, and it's very interesting. Two of the things which make China different from Cuba is, one, that the Cubans have this social safety net, which in a way is kind of ties their hands behind their back. It's a huge burden for the state. They're trying to provide full employment, therefore it's very difficult to move labor from one place to the other. So it is a more controlled economy than the other thing. And the other thing is, for Cuba, the export-led growth model without the U.S. market doesn't look as attractive. And I think that if the U.S. market was there, you'd see a lot more change in terms of domestic reform in Cuba, because they would have to move faster. They would have to take those opportunities to integrate the domestic economy with the external economy.
Question here.
Stephanie Bidzina.
Since Dr. Maris just came back from Cuba, I would like you to expand on Dr. Ritter's models. Just coming back from there, and maybe Dr. Ritter can also tell us this when he comes back as well, man on the street perspective pertaining to his models, what does the man on the street feel is most eminent and what are they most ready for in terms of Dr. Ritter's models?
Purely anecdotal input, of course, but they are expecting great things from a new administration, from the United States. Obama's name was on the lips of many people. Whenever I visit Cuba, I never discuss politics. I don't ask people their opinions on anything, but I listen. And, the taxi drivers and the porters and the agents in the hotel and other folks are all talking about change. They're very optimistic about an improved relationship with the United States. I think because they've been so isolated from the reality of the larger world, that they possibly are misunderstanding the benefits that will accrue to them in the near term. I agree there's some very rough road ahead. I believe that even though access to television and internet is quite restricted, they see these popular shows on TV, and many of the folks that I talk with think they're going to have all these luxuries in the near term. I can recall flying back from Moscow many years ago, shortly after the change in government there, and there was a gentleman who is a New York-based Russian-American businessman who had just returned from a trip to Moscow. We was going to set up a business. And he asked me, finding out that I'd been working in Russia, he said, well, how soon do you think that our country will have all the benefits and luxuries that you have? And before I could answer, he said, 3 years, 5 years? I said, 75 years, 100 years? And he couldn't understand that. And I think much will be the same with the Cuban people. I have great love and respect for the Cuban people. They have been, so put upon for so many years for so many reasons. They are looking for a brighter day ahead. I think that day is coming. I don't know what the pace will be. So I think they certainly are not expecting the status quo. They're looking for new leadership, younger leadership.
I haven't been there since the U.S. election, so I haven't got the latest. I imagine, though, the people I know were already, that the expectations are building up within Cuba for change. The removal of the great enemy in the United States actually puts huge pressure on the Cuban government to bring about change, because their excuse will be gone. And it seems to me that it thoroughly changes the picture.
I could probably answer this question a little better in about 2 weeks, and that's I can only speculate now. But in my experience, each Cuban is optimistic and pessimistic with a different balance all the time. And when a new fact comes in that can unleash the optimistic side, another fact can come in that unleashes the pessimistic side. So in that sense, Cubans are like the U.S. stock market, eh? It's based on expectations, and any new little bit of information can change those expectations and lead to irrational exuberance or irrational pessimism. So that's a hard question to answer, but my guess, I can answer better later on, is that Cubans are now in an enthusiastic, optimistic, positive phase, thinking that Cuba will become a normal country, and that their situation will improve. But I'll answer that. Give me your name. I'll phone you in 2 weeks.
Let's have one more question, and then we'll have the gentleman here.
I think I disagree with all of you.
Could
in
you
one area. I have a feeling that within Steve Landy, Manchester Trade, having said that, I shouldn't identify myself. But anyway, I really believe that with the Obama administration, we're going to see a much faster movement towards normalization than you expect. Having said that, let's just assume that's correct. No one knows, of course, and so on, et cetera. And let's forget a moment about the economic problems in the U.S., whether we actually get worse than the Great Depression, I don't know. But let's just assume the U.S. remains okay, remains balanced. What would happen with your forecasts if the immigrants were able to send the money back to Cuba like they want, make investments. Maybe there's no investments to make. I assume you'll see an amazing investment in tourism will take place on short notice. What will that do? Put in your terms, what will this do to the Celtic example if it became a Celtic Miami-Cuban example in terms of money going back and enthusiasm? Thank you.
Okay. I don't disagree with you. I mean, it's not my central forecast yet because I'm going to have to wait a little bit longer before I see a sign that they actually make that breakthrough that I described. If they do make that breakthrough, I do think it will have an enormous impact on Cuba, on the Cuban economy. And like you say, that the money would start to come through. I can't envisage, and I think it's another stage, you know, you'd have to see more happening. What I see is the Cuban government, whichever government it is, you know, ruling out a rupture, would remain an interventionist government. There would remain a large degree of state ownership and heavy regulation of private enterprise. That doesn't mean that there wouldn't be much more scope for bilateral trade and even for bilateral small business investment and all the rest of it. And I think that it's, you know, it would be interesting to do a few scenarios because I think that growth potential is enormous. I think the Cuban economy could grow and could double in size within not very many years at all.
I'd like to, I'm sorry, Arch, go ahead.
It's hard to predict how normalization will proceed. I think there will be some steps I don't know how fast it's going to be myself. I think with full normalization, you're right, we would see major things going on. We would see the Miami-Havana axis becoming incredibly powerful, incredibly beneficial for everybody, for the Cuban-Americans in Miami, for the Cubans in Cuba. We'd see entrepreneurship from Miami going into Cuba. We would see the snowbird tourism or a lot of people retiring in Cuba in timeshare condominiums or purchased apartments. I think normalization and some sort of marketization in Cuba, both of those together would generate very rapid and very significant prosperity in Cuba. And in time, I'm sure that will happen, but I don't know when.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I think understated in all these remarks and these good questions has been the role that the military has played to date in the economy and that it will play in the future. Currently, the Cuban military controls over 60% of the economy of Cuba, and I think in a post-succession transition scenario, it's likely that the same people who are the players now will be the players then. And this may not necessarily be a bad thing because these folks have collectively done quite well under some very austere conditions. You know, some of the positions may change, but I would look for a significant representation of military leadership in whatever scenario does prevail in the near term.
This has been super. Thank you very much to our three distinguished panelists. Thank you all for coming.